Okay, welcome everyone to this very special session of Marxism 2011. We're actually having a book launch of Tom O'Lincoln's new book, which has just come out, called Australia's Pacific War, Challenging a National Myth. And no doubt this is going to be an extremely controversial contribution to Australian history, and in particular the question of the Second World War. But before we do that, I'm actually going to invite... because the session is entitled What is Wrong with Anzac Day? And Tom said that that's not exactly what he's going to be talking about. So we have an additional speaker, Kyla Cassells, who is one of the organisers of Marxism, but she is also writing or wrote her honours thesis on the myth of Anzac Day. So she's going to be speaking briefly about that.
Yeah, so I'm just going to be speaking briefly about Anzac Day because I'm sure, as everyone in the room knows, that tomorrow actually marks, I think it's the 94th anniversary since Australian forces invaded Turkey in an invasion that killed nearly 9,000 Australian soldiers and over 20,000 Turkish soldiers and many more from other parts of the world. And yet this day is the most sacred secular event, I think, on the Australian calendar. It's an event that... is touted by conservative commentators as being the birth of the nation, the most important defining event in Australian history. But I think for left-wing people, it's actually important to have a sense of what this day is actually about. And I think that Anzac Day is actually a celebration of Australian imperialism, it's a veneration of militarism and war, and very importantly, it's a nationalist event that always has been about actually glossing over class divisions and blunting class tensions. Now, during the First World War, Anzac Day was actually commemorated, as a means of at first recruiting soldiers, mostly Australian working class men, to go over to the other side of the world and fight and die for the British Empire. And in 1916 and 1917, it also played an important role in actually for conservative forces attempting to galvanise support for conscription. But after the war, there was a period in which Anzac Day was barely celebrated at all, because actually the situation in Australia at the end of the First World War was one of deep radicalisation in the working class, because the experience on the home front of massive inflation, of deprivation, and the experience of having tens of thousands of soldiers die in the First World War and thousands more come home mangled and broken human beings really undermined any sense that this was an event that was in any way worth celebrating or commemorating. But by the mid-1920s, conservative forces actually revived Anzac Day as a means of deflecting anger away from government authorities around failure of the soldier settlement schemes, which was a government scheme that basically herded returned soldiers up out of the city where they were, a problem, out in the middle of nowhere on these tiny, unviable farms where that were destined to collapse. And in the mid-1920s, as these farms started to collapse, Anzac Day was revived as a celebration of, the sacrifice of the soldiers and all that they had given up, the commemoration of the people who died in ceremonies, elaborate ceremonies, that involved tens of thousands of people, basically as a way of deflecting attention away from all the anger that was simmering below the surface. And it was highly successful in doing this, and so this carried on throughout the Great Depression as a means of deflecting the heightened class tensions that existed. And you can sort of see the logic in it. I've got this quote from the Naval Staff Office in 1932, and it's really, really telling, actually, what they say about Anzac Day. And this is a quote. One of its greatest claims to distinction is a levelling of all present ranks, occupations and class distinctions. The units are led by their old officers, and in the ranks, capital and labour for once march side by side. So from, from its very beginnings, it was an event that was... his whole purpose was about glossing over class distinctions, promoting conservative nationalism, and a certain celebration of war. And this, you sort of see the role that this plays in the fact that, you know, Anzac Day, throughout its history, has had certain surges in popularity and wanes depending on the needs of the ruling class. So during the Great Depression and the World War II, it had a certain surge of popularity. Then after the war, and as the anti-war sentiments, the Vietnam War sort of broke out, it had a real decline in fortunes, only to be revived again in the 1980s, with lots of, going on by people like Hawke and Keating about, you know, needing to sacrifice for the national good in the context of economic recession and massive attacks on social spending. And of course, in more recent years, under the Howard government, it also played an important role in, celebrating militarism and, playing a role in justifying interventions into places like East Timor, Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, one of the defences that is commonly made of Anzac Day, though, is that it's not actually a celebration of militarism or any of this kind of stuff. What it actually is it's a commemoration of the dead. You know, it's recognising the sacrifices of all these people who have died in these wars. And for me, the absolute lie of this defence, it can be, I think, exposed in one story, which is the story of a man called Fred Farrell. Fred Farrell was a returned soldier from the First World War. He fought in the Somme in France, where he watched many of his close friends die. And after the First World War, he suffered from shell shock, what we today would call post-traumatic stress disorder. In the 1920s, he became involved in the labour movement, and in the 1930s, during the Great Depression, he joined the Communist Party. Now, Fred was not welcome at Anzac Day ceremonies, and his local RSL actually banned him from attending the dawn services and the other events that they put on. In 1937, he was arrested at an Anzac Day march for distributing anti-war propaganda. Mm. And when he died in 1987, he was still barred from his local RSL. So, you know, his exclusion was on the basis that he actually opposed imperialism and war. And I think this is a real, like, telling about the nature of Anzac Day. Because for all it talks about, you know, how horrible it is that people go and die in wars, at the end of the day, what it's about is actually about celebrating imperialism. It's about, recognising the sacrifice and the valour of those who died in these wars. And the revolt, as the result, is actually a fairly sickening situation when you think about the logic of it, where you have small children wearing the war medals of their deceased relatives in a celebration of a day which marks the beginning of an invasion that killed 20,000 Turkish people and many more soldiers from other countries. And so I think for left-wing people, for people like me in this room, that is actually the spirit in which we should remember Anzac Day and its real purpose.
Okay, so we've got time for discussion after Tomo Lincoln speaks. So I'd now like to introduce Tomo Lincoln, the author of the book which I mentioned at the beginning. Tom has been a long-term socialist, active since the 60s. He came to Australia when? 1971, and helped establish the group, which was the precursor of Socialist Alternative, and I'm very proud and happy to introduce you all to Tom today so that he can speak on the topic of his new book. So please give him a big welcome.
You may have noticed I was having a little look around to see if Oprah Winfrey made it today, but she's not here. Which is a pity, because I wanted to start a book club. But what I will do instead is introduce you to a number of books as we go through the themes that I want to talk about. And when I finish doing that, I'll be interviewed by the police under the Trade Practices Act for misrepresenting the content of the presentation, because although it will start off from ANZAC as a kind of starting point, is really a consideration of a couple of long-term trends in Australian politics and history, which is on the one hand militarism and on the other hand nationalism and how they counteract. The secondary title, which is Celebrating Slaughter, which I agitated for until I got it. Now I wish I'd picked another one because it raises an issue that I want to discuss anyway. Which is this, and Kyla alluded to it, if you go and you talk to the leadership of the RSL or some politician speaking on an army platform or whatever it is, and you say, you're glorifying war, you're glorifying killing, you will get an indignant response.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I used to just think this is hypocrisy, you know, but I still think, you know, a lot of it's hypocrisy, but I think there's a social phenomenon as well that we need to consider, and I think it probably goes back to the industrial-scale carnage of the First World War, and where it became much less acceptable to your average citizen to celebrate the idea of a hero that goes out there and kills a lot of people. The killing is this virtuous thing. I think that's receded somewhat. And I began to look over the last year or two at public figures to see how they managed, you know, this situation. And what did they say instead of glorifying killing, which I think they do generally avoid. And I listened to Julia Gillard with her message to the troops in Afghanistan, and I listened to the Governor General speak at the Dawn Service. And what I noticed about Julia Gillard, and she talks about how great the troops are, and then she talks about how some of them have died. And she turns and she looks into the camera, and this is the power moment, and she says, they died for us. They died for us. Now, I ask myself, if you're an average citizen watching this, they had a thing that connected to it, which was you could send your own message to the troops in Afghanistan. What sort of message would they get? Now, some of you and me, we'd send an anti-war message. Most other people in Australia are against the war in Afghanistan, but would they send an anti-war message after that? I don't think so. I think they would say to themselves, well, the war is a terrible thing, but I'm not going to lay this on the shoulders of these young people. They're prepared to die for me. So there is an exploitation, instead of the killing, an exploitation of the dying. And this is very useful, I think, to the capitalist system and to militarism, because you can shove a lot of stuff under the rug this way. Now imagine if I talk about the killing side. Imagine someone comes to our country, like Lars, for example, who's kind enough to visit me. And I say, well, look, we had this great episode in our history. We sent our young men off to a country they knew nothing or very little about. We got them, made them invade that country. They blew people's heads off. How cool is that? This is not, you know, very marketable now. So you talk about the dying instead. And the same theme, I notice, is picked up by Henry Reynolds in this book. It's the first one I'll talk about. I'll talk off and on quite a bit about this one, which came out about a year ago, which is What's Wrong with ANZAC. And he points out the same thing, that there is a move away from the killing to the dying, and how this is used to cover things up and get awkward stuff off the agenda. And he cites a report from the front line of Gallipoli, which says, and I'm quoting this here, it says, when the ANZAC's blood was up, they went searching for fresh enemies to bayonet. Now, you don't want that coming out. It's much simpler to talk about the dying. And I think to make points of this kind, Henry Reynolds and Marilyn Lake, who are the main contributors to this book, have done, I think, a very courageous job. And I used that word in a book review a year ago, and I stand by it. I think it was courageous, given where they come from and everything else, to take on the militarist establishment as the way they did. But at the same time, it's amazing how many things I disagree with in this book. And I think that's kind of useful because it gives me a little itinerary to work through on some of the issues. And the center of the disagreement is nationalism. Now, you see, we look at Anzac Day and we look at the militarism and the history of the wars and so on. And our answer to militaristic nationalism is international socialism. Get rid of the national boundaries. Get rid of the national differences. Unite the peoples of the world. Then we won't need wars anymore. And I know that all sounds very simplistic when I put it that way, but I just sort of put that there as a summary, as a kind of marker for where we stand on this. But that is not where most of the Australian left stands or has stood for a considerable period of time historically. The majority view, effectively on the left, the actionable, the action agenda, is to get a different kind of nationalism. A progressive nationalism, a left nationalism, a nicer nationalism, national identity, whatever. And that's very much what the authors of this book are about. They reject the common view that I think Kyla alluded to, that nations are formed in battle. They find that offensive. And they want to replace this. They say, why can't our social order be based on, let's say, humanitarian values, my term, you know, equality, democracy, things like that. Why can't we base our community on that? And I agree. Why can't we base the community on that? But when the next step is, we want to base an Australian identity on this. It's a bit more problematic. It's a bit like that Aussie spirit thing. Oh, you know, if you help your neighbor out in the middle of a flood, you must be an Australian. You have these, you know, I won't take any notes.
Oh, you don't want
to?
Okay.
You must be an Australian. Where was I here? So that but if you start to claim these things for a national identity, you start to get into trouble. You start to be offensive, first of all. As if the people of Cairo have less claim on democracy than the people of Melbourne, Australia. That's offensive. But I don't really think that's particularly what they mean. It's confused. And the confusion gets you into trouble. And one of them is a quote, which I checked it and I've marked it in the book and I put a bookmark in because I couldn't believe it. Marilyn Lake refers, she attacks racism right through the book, but at a certain point she refers to basing Australian identity on, and I quote, our pioneering achievements in extending equal rights to Indigenous Australians. what planet is this on? I'm serious. She's not a nut. I'm not saying she's a racist. Far from it. She said, tax racism through the book. Henry Reynolds has a fabulous record of campaigning for the historical recognition of the struggles of Aboriginal people. But this, how can this happen? It's because you get into these contradictions. But if it was just contradictions, it wouldn't be such a huge problem. But left nationalism confuses our ability to understand the way in which the Australian state goes to war. And basically, the standard left nationalist story, oh, I should say, I'm leaving aside the most important single war in our history, which is the war on Indigenous people, because that is a huge discussion in its own right. But I'm talking about the war fought by the Australian state against its capitalist rival. The standard left story about these wars is basically, we're fighting in Vietnam, for example, nothing really to do with Australia. Australia's a nice country. We were dragged into it by the Americans. And if we have a critique of our rulers, which we certainly do, the most common critique of our rulers is John Howard is a lapdog for George Bush. In other words, what's wrong with our leaders is they need assertiveness training. This is the left, kind of the left nationalist picture. And Henry Reynolds picks it up in the 19th century. He writes about colonial military adventures, which is actually very interesting and important. He writes about sending the troops off to the Sudan. That's 19th century. And sending troops to the Boer War, which is just poking into the 20th century, but I think of it as colonial. And he says to himself, you can see, what on earth are these Australians going off halfway around the world to Africa to fight for the British Empire? This is silly. How do we explain it? Well, basically his explanation is the colonists were silly. That this is just irrational, this is blind empire patriotism with no logic to it. And he gives a story to illustrate this, which is very funny and very telling, and he's quite right to quote it, about a Labour MP who's having a friendly argument with the Premier of WA. And the Labour MP says, our people here in the colony, they don't know the rights and wrongs of this war in Southern Africa. To which the Premier of WA replies, we do not want to know. Now, this is part of war mobilization, is fostering of ignorant and blind jingoism, no doubt whatsoever. But this cannot possibly be the whole explanation for why Australian colonies are sending troops off to Africa. And Geoffrey Blainey, who wrote easily the most penetrating review of this, except, of course, for mine, a very, very powerful right-wing review of this book, which he entitled, We Weren't That Dumb. Right? Very interesting. He picks this up and he says, this can't be right. Obviously, there's fools in every community, but there must have been smart people with smart agendas. And, of course, there were. And there was a colonial imperialist agenda that it's very important to understand, which is basically that the colonists, sections of the ruling class and agitators in the colonies, wanted to expand the boundaries of empire in this part of the world. They wanted to occupy and seize Papua New Guinea. They wanted to seize the New Hebrides. They wanted to seize Fiji. They wanted to expand the local empire. Their problem was, a lot of the time, the British government was not interested. South Pacific is a long way away. You know, we got other wars to fight. The bloody colonists, they never shut up, you know, with their agenda. And so the colonists had to find a way to get leverage with the British government. And one way to do that was to send troops to their colonial imperial adventures. And you do that, and then the British government sort of comes in behind you and you're with your agenda in the Pacific. That's the idea. It doesn't always work. Roger Thompson, who has written the most authoritative study of all this colonial imperial stuff, puts it this way. He says, with regard to sending troops to the Sudan, a demonstrated willingness to come to the mother country's aid highlighted Britain's failure to fully defend Australia's interest in the Pacific and might make the British government more accommodating in future. So you can see behind there is an imperialist agenda on the part of these people sending troops off to the Sudan. Okay, so we come to World War I, which is obviously very important when we talk about Anzac Day. The left portrayal fits World War I as well. That is, what was World War I with the fighting in the trenches in France? What did that have to do with Australia? Why are Australians going over there? They must be manipulated into it by the British. You know, they must be lapdogs for the British. And Henry Reynolds picks up the one piece of genuine evidence, which is interesting to know about, that there was in fact an attempt by the British, and I'm not saying it wasn't effective, to play on Australian fears of invasion, including the Yellow Peril fears, to try to persuade the colonists to send troops to back up Britain in what was going to be World War I. This is before the war. They did do that. But you could just as easily see it from the Australian point of view. Here is an opportunity. In order to get British support for this agenda we've got in the Pacific, we will join their wars. And I think there are three reasons why Australia was involved in World War I, and none of them had to do with the fact that the leaders of Australia were lapdogs. The first is that there were markets in the British Empire that were obviously important, and the Australian government wanted to preserve them. The second is that there were islands in the Pacific where the Germans had been chased out at the start of World War I. There were islands in the Pacific that the Australians had occupied, but that was initially a temporary situation. How do you guarantee that you turn these things into colonies, as was eventually done with the League of Nations mandate system? How do you do this? You need backing from the British, and you need approval from the post-war Paris Peace Conference. You know, there's going to be a peace conference. You need leverage. And Billy Hughes was able to get leverage because of the investment in World War I. He goes to Paris saying something like, I speak for 60,000 dead Australians. The leverage, the imperial leverage here, is results from playing a role in this European war. And there's something else connected to it, which is white Australia. Because they're the rising power in the Pacific is Japan. Japan is not going to put up forever with white Australia policy and racial discrimination. It's going to be a challenge at the Paris Peace Conference. How are you going to fight this off? And moreover, how are you going to ensure that you can impose the same racial policies on these islands you're going to take over? You need to have leverage at this conference through fighting the war. And if you have any doubt about it, there is a statement from Billy Hughes, which comes out of a secret closed parliamentary session. So we don't know, we don't have Hansard, we don't have the exact words, but we have the word of an intelligence officer, so it's probably reliable. Japan would challenge the white Australia policy after the war. To resist, Australia would need help from the rest of the empire, and if she wanted to be sure of getting it, she must now throw her full strength into defending Britain. So you can see the white Australia policy is connected to this apparently unrelated war in Europe. And the same story goes on with Vietnam. Theoretically, according to the left nationalists, we were dragged into Vietnam by the Americans. But this book by Greg Pemberton called All the Way illustrates very clearly that, in fact, there were the Australian chiefs of staff were putting pressure on the Americans to get them deeper into Vietnam. Why are they doing this? Because the more the Americans are committed in Asia, the more they are likely to back up Australia's specific interests while they're at it. So you can see that there is this imperialist agenda running right through the history of Australian wars, except there's another point now that Geoffrey Blainey picks up on that's very important as well. He says, interesting book, covers a great sort of territory, a great expanse of wars, and militarism, but there's something missing. Where is the Second World War? And there is some reference to it, but he's right. They don't really say much about how this fits into their critique. And Blainey says, well, shouldn't we have been in this war, and so on. Raises the issue. And we know the answer. We know why they didn't deal with World War II. There are two reasons. One is that it's too hard. And let's not be dismissive of this. It's only lunatics like me that, you know, are really game to get involved in challenging the logic of the Second World War. It's a very hard thing to do. But there's another reason, which is that the Second World War fits into this pattern of the nice nationalism. Now, the left nationalism. You see, Anzac Day is the nationalism of the right. We don't want to be too vulgar about this, but it's Anglophile, it's right-wing, it's conservative, and the left did not like it. The left remembered the mass anti-conscription campaigns of World War I, and they remembered the 1917 general strike, they remembered the IWW, the Wobblies, and the repression, they remembered the Easter Rising in Dublin, they remembered the Russian Revolution that came out of hostility to World War I. There was a lot of left hostility to Anzac Day, and Kyla's told you a bit about that as well. What World War II did was it dropped the left, drew the left into the project of building a national identity. Well, how did this happen? Primarily a question of the Communist Party. The Communist Party was anti-war up to a certain point, and then the Soviet Union entered the European War, and then that then meant that the Australian Communist Party was on instructions to build a close alliance and align itself with the Australian state. The Australian state is then immersed in a nationalist and racist war with Japan, and the Communist Party is not immune to any of that either. And you can see how the left is pulled into the nationalist program. Before the war, Ian Turner explains what the outlook of many left-wingers in Australia in the 1930s. They believed, he says, the worker had no fatherland. Patriotism was the last refuge of the munitions maker. All men were brothers, and nationalism stood on the lunatic fringe. World War II changed all that. And it created what I call an alternative Anzac. If you don't like Anzac Day, there is this other alternative. And you can see how World War II has been developed in this way over a period of time. Paul Keating made a speech in 1992 outside Port Moresby, which he attacked the Anglophile quality of Anzac Day and held up the Kokoda Trail and the fighting in the beginning of World War II as much more a stinkum Australian kind of war to fight. And you can see this in the way that Kokoda has become a tourism attraction. Just like Anzac Cove, you know, backpackers, it's on the agenda for one or the other, or both. There's a whole concept now of the so-called Battle for Australia, which suggests basically that Australia saved the world by fighting in Papua, and this is comparable to the Battle of Britain, or whatever. In fact, there was no Battle for Australia, and that's another story. And there's a novel, and this is indicative, I think, how it comes into literature, a novel for adolescents called Angels of Kokoda. The angels refers to the fuzzy-wuzzy angels who were the Papuan characters carrying the Australian soldiers. And there's an anti-racist message in that, and I don't want to be totally dismissive of the book. In some ways, it's quite a nice readable book. But anyway, it's built around Kokoda. And this guy is a veteran of Kokoda, and towards the end of the book, he's writing back to, I think, his nephew, and he writes as follows. I'm not knocking the Greeks at Thermopylae, or the Yanks at the Alamo, or even our own Gallipoli, but they don't rank against the Battle of the Kokoda Track that saved Australia. Not anywhere near. There's never been anything like those battles. Nowhere. Never. Aussie, 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 oi, oi, oi. Now, one day, a populist prime minister is going to be fighting a war, which Paul Keating wasn't, and they will use this tradition as an alternative Anzac. So it becomes important to critique it. There's one other thing about this alternative Anzac that makes it attractive. As Kyla pointed out, Gallipoli was an invasion of somebody else's country. And this argument came out very much in the debate about the Anzac book, that the trouble with Gallipoli is it was an invasion, we were the aggressors, why celebrate that? At Kokoda, we were defending ourselves. The assumption then there was the Japanese had a plan to invade Australia, they were going to occupy Australia, and we have a right to defend ourselves, this is progressive. Now, the reality is quite different. And I'll introduce you to another book, which is, oddly enough, entitled Invading Australia by Peter Stanley, but the title is ironic. What Peter Stanley has done is brought together, I wouldn't say he demonstrated it because I think it was already demonstrated by scholars, but he's brought together the arguments that show the Japanese did not plan to invade Australia. They did not plan to occupy Australia. Not because they were nice or anything, but just the realities of their assessment. They did not plan to invade Australia. So the question then arises, and Peter Stanley has to confront this one, if the war was not about defending Australia, what was it about? Why fight the war in the 1940s? And he has an answer, which is very attractive. It really endears me to him. as an individual. And he says, look, the old narrative about World War II was that it was an international campaign for democracy and against dictatorship. And it was, Australians were proud to be part of that. It was a noble thing to be part of that. And it's a great sentiment. And he quotes the Australian Prime Minister, John Curtin, who said shortly after the fall of Singapore, said, we are at war with Japan because our vital interests are imperiled and because the rights of free people in the whole Pacific are assailed. That's what John Curtin says. There's only one problem with this quote. Where are these free peoples of Asia? Well, there's Australia and New Zealand, which are liberal democracies, but they are, in fact, the outposts of empire, the white outposts of empire. Right? So they don't invalidate the argument. But let's look at the rest. The Philippines, controlled by the United States after a brutal war of annexation. Papua New Guinea, colonized by Australia. Indonesia, colonized by the Dutch, quite brutally. Singapore, Malaya, colonized by the British. Indochina, colonized by the French. You see the point. There were no free peoples of Asia. The war at the start was about colonial powers, imperial powers, trying to maintain their colonies. And at the end of the war, it was about trying to either reimpose the same setup, or if that was no longer viable, to do what was called neocolonialism and do it less directly. But it's not about freedom. None of it's about freedom. So we arrive at the conclusion that the war is not about democracy and freedom. Neither is it about defending Australia. It's not about either of those things. What's left? It's about a battle over who controls the territory. It is about imperialist war on both sides. And that is a pretty controversial topic, so we'd better see if there's another book which takes the show. It seems to be, modesty forbids me to say who the author is, but it's written on the cover, so you'll figure it out. So that was how I arrived at the need for this book. And I'm obviously not going to try now to tell you all the stuff that's in it. What I'd like to do is to take a couple of minutes and talk about the structure of the thing, just the overarching plan. Helps you a little bit, I think, to read it. The first four chapters are about the imperialist nature of the war. And the first chapter is about the systemic quality of it, that there was a cycle of imperial conflict, and I'm not so interested in talking about whose fault it is, because it's a cycle. That's the whole point about it. And how Japan and Australia emerge into this cycle as well. The second chapter is very much about the war specifically, and the point I made that it was not a war of liberation, that it was effectively a colonial / imperial war. The third chapter is about the occupation of Japan. One of the ironies is that for all the talk about Japan invading Australia, actually it was Australia, in a way, invaded Japan and participated in oppressive occupation. There's a long, curious history to that. The fourth chapter is about racism. Should not surprise anyone. Racism is the ideological cement. I used to usually say this about Federation. It's the ideological cement also of imperialism, and in particular in the era we're talking about. So that's the first section of it. There are then two other sections. There's a section on war crimes, atrocities, stereotypes, very unpleasant stuff. You know, don't feel obliged to read. You don't like reading this stuff. Okay, it's not compulsory. I mean, I'm not doing a joke about this. It's some very sad stuff in it on both sides. But I felt it was essential to address the question that will be thrown at me and no doubt you, but weren't the Japanese so bad that we had to stop them? You know, the rape of Nanjing and so on. The Japanese imperialism was pretty awful, and nobody should fall into the trap of trying to apologize for it in any way. But you start looking at what the West did with its resources in a much cleaner pair of hands, but the same, you know, end result, you find out that it's not so nice either. And so I wanted to open that question of the West, whether it has any right to claim the moral high ground. And the final section is about the home front in Australia, if I can call it that. One chapter about social conflict, that this was not a united nation fighting a heroic battle. It was in fact a class-divided society, and divided in other ways as well, and writing on sexual politics and so on. And finally, there's a chapter with showing some of the myths about the war, which I think the one people will find most interesting is the final one, which shows that the Australian Army was not the democratic organization it's made out to be, that it was in fact a highly hierarchical and oppressive organization. One characteristic example being the fact that every officer had a servant in the Australian Army, called a batman. It's totally different if they're called a batman. So we're almost finished. Let me finish with something from a POW. This is very important. because the POWs have a huge emotional importance, and no one should be, again, trying to suggest in any way the Japanese, you know, get off the hook on the treatment of Australian POWs. That was pretty bad. But what's interesting is what some of them had to say. And I'll read you one now, and I'll read you a better one later. The one now is in the book at the end, but I wish I'd used the other one, but it's too late now because it's published. I got it too late. In 1948, a remarkable letter in the Sydney Morning Herald, the author, one Charles Huxtable, the epitome of respectability, a doctor so conservative he felt nervous about the advent of a Labour government in Britain. Decorated in two world wars and had spent time as a POW. As a medical officer in Changi, he had seen the terrible consequences of the suffering of POWs on the Burma-Thailand Railway. Yet he called for mercy in the Tokyo War Crimes Trial, which was just bringing down its verdicts. All sides needed to be self-critical, he wrote. Quote, the wider Pacific War was bitter, racial, and merciless, and the cruelties of which the enemy were guilty did not exceed those practiced by us. In reply to another correspondent, he continued the argument. In the Allied war effort, he said, soldiers had been taught and made to do things they didn't like. He could tell disturbing stories about this from first-hand accounts. The Allies seemed to have adopted a policy of, he said, ruthless extermination of the enemy with no quarter given. As a result, they had forfeited any right to sit in judgment on Japan as a nation. Not perfect politics, but very, very brave thing to write in the Sydney Morning Herald in 1948. And I reckon if he could do it, we can do it.